Hello and welcome to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Augustine Macellari.
On the show today, we'll be speaking to art commentator and curator Kate Bryan about her new book, The Art of Love.
We'll also be hearing from musician Erland Cooper about his latest album, So Scary.
And we'll be hearing from an art pioneer, the painter, printmaker and sculptor Frank Stella, about his life and work.
That's all to come, plus Monaco's Paige Reynolds will be here with some of next week's news as well, right here on the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. It's quite warm today, actually, in London. It's about like 25 degrees. I like that. I needed that.
Indeed, but there's no lovely bank holiday Monday tomorrow. We've had a rash of bank holidays. Well, look, should we check in? It's time to look to the week ahead. Monocle's Paige Reynolds is here.
My first story will be Donald Trump in London. So Air Force One will be touching down on British tarmac tomorrow as Trump arrives in the UK for his first state visit. So as we know, he previously visited the UK back in 2018. That was an official visit. This time it comes at the invitation of the Queen herself. So during this visit, he's expected to meet various members of the royal family. He'll also be taking part in D-Day celebrations on June 5th. And he'll also have a private meeting with Prime Minister Theresa May. Interesting timing here, of course, as she'll be hanging up her coloured clogs on Friday. So I think that will be a sort of discussion point. Another discussion point might be the protests, which are also likely to take place. Donald Trump's last trip to the UK saw about 250,000 protesters and a big inflatable baby Trump blimp. So I think the mascot of choice might be in question. Some say the blimp is back, the baby blimp is back. There's another mascot, though, as well. A Philadelphia-based anti-Trump campaigner has said that he's shipping a 4.9-metre dumping Trump robot, which, as the name suggests, features Trump sat on the loo, playing recordings of common Trump phrases such as a witch hunt, you are fake news, and I'm a very stable genius.
I wonder about the protests, because, you know, they were quite popular last time, but now with, you know, Brexit about to happen, you know, they're choosing a new leader of the Conservative Party. I wonder if there will be as many people this time. Predictions, Paige?
I'm not sure. I personally, I'm just as riled up about Trump as I was before, so no change there. I imagine a number of the women in this country will perhaps be thinking the same.
Indeed. Well, here's hoping the baby blimp returns to our skies. What else have you got for us?
Talking of skies, Augustine. My next story is about the skies, is about airlines. British Airways is resuming flights to Pakistan as of June 2nd. So BA halted service to Pakistan in the wake of the 2008 Marriott hotel bombing in Islamabad. And after a decade, BA is going to be the first Western airline to resume flights to Islamabad. So BA have said they're going to launch a 3-per-week service from London Heathrow. And it will begin with the airline's newest long-haul aircraft, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. At present, it's only the national carrier, Pakistan International Airlines, that flies directly from Pakistan to Britain. Qatar Airways, Etihad Airways, Emirates and Turkish Airlines also have presence in Pakistan, but British Airways will be the first Western carrier there. Since 2008, security in the country has improved significantly, and Islamabad has been sort of running international advertising campaigns, trying to sort of rejuvenate its tourism sector. So hopefully this is a good sign for Pakistan.
So we do think that it reflects some sort of improvement in diplomatic relations, faith in the state apparatus to forestall any sort of terrorist attacks, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so.
So the only thing to worry about is the 737 crashing on its own.
Indeed, perhaps a worry some will have after recent times. So lastly, I'm going to take you to a really important day of mine, which is happening this Tuesday.
Oh my God.
You can't do one of your gigs on the road.
This is none other than National Cheese Day on June 4th. I had to mention this one. I'm usually not in favour of these sort of fabricated national days, sort of invented by people that have very little to do.
Cheese salesman.
But National Cheese Day I can make an exception for, not to be confused with National Cheese Lovers Day, which happens earlier in the year, and Grilled Cheese Sandwich Day, which also exists. So we don't actually know, apparently, when cheese making began, but it was being well-documented well since the Roman Empire. But I've got some cheesy facts for you before I make my exit.
Fact.
Roquefort, Brie de Meaux and Casamarzo are illegal cheeses in the US. Who knew?
Unpasteurized.
Perhaps.
Yeah, it'll be that.
The European Union is the top producer of cheese in the world. The US is the second top producer of cheese in the world. And it's Wisconsin that is the sort of highest, is the dairy state, as it were. And last year, Wisconsin created the world's largest cheese board, setting a new Guinness World Record. The platter had just over 2,000 kilos of Wisconsin cheese, which smashed the old European record out of the park, which was only 450 kilos. The cheese board was 35 feet by 7 feet wide and had 145 different varieties of
cheese. It's a shame that, because American cheese is by reputation absolutely vile, isn't it?
Indeed. So,
do you have a favourite cheese?
Well, this is what I was gonna. This is what I was,
yeah,
I was gonna
that's
ask.
That's the most important
before.
Question.
Not favourite cheese, but what I would like to ask you is, if you were asked to bring a cheese to a wine and cheese night, what would you bring? I asked this because recently I was at one of these wine and cheese nights, and someone brought cheesy singles.
Oh. I seem to remember someone bringing separately 8 camembert as well. Which is what happens if you allow people to make up their own minds. I can answer this very quickly. If I could bring any cheese, I'd bring kazumatsu, which is a kind of Sardinian pecorino. Mm. What they do is they cut the top off a young pecorino and leave it in a shepherd's hut for a few days, where a specific type of fly comes and lays its little eggs in the cheese. These hatch into tiny maggots, which go through it and digest it. And you eat the cheese with the maggots still in it, wriggling away. It's a great topic of conversation. You know, will people eat it? Won't they eat it? Will they be sick? Will they enjoy it? Unfortunately, you can't get it in the UK. It is banned by the EU. Better
and,
out.
And banned in the US. That was one of my US illegal cheeses.
Banned in the US as well.
I think I'll be a bit more basic and just bring, I love a good Parmigiano.
On its own?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But it's nice enough.
And a glass of red as well, of course.
Okay.
Paige, thank you so much for joining us and giving us that whirlwind look at the week ahead.
Kate Bryan's work can be seen throughout the art world, having presented art programs for outlets such as the BBC and Sky Arts, to her role as head of collections for Soho House.
Her latest project looks at art from a collaborative viewpoint, and a romantic one too, for a new book, The Art of Love. It collects the stories of some of art's most influential duos, from Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera to Joseph and Annie Albers, and, of course, London's very own Gilbert and George. She joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Kate.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's a fantastic book. Why don't you just start us off by telling us a bit about the background to it?
Well, I always want to try and do things to bring bigger audiences to art. I feel really passionately that everybody makes art when they're a kid. Everybody is somehow an artist. You know, Picasso always said that. Every child is an artist. It's staying an artist as you grow up that's the problem. And so I thought, how can I sort of find an angle which will satiate art lovers who go to museums and galleries, who already know Pollock and Krasner's name, but will also maybe bring a bigger audience in and kind of open a door? So I wanted something that was good looking, wanted something that was accessible, and it needed to have a subject that had a good hook. And I thought, well, we all love a good love story. So that was the plan.
And Kate, I mean, me and Og were discussing before the interview. It's interesting when two artists get together, things can become a bit problematic. Did you notice, is this a pattern from the couples that you've researched in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by the idea of two artists in one relationship. If you think about it, it's already extraordinary enough to be an artist, to just not really have a proper job, to decide that you're going to spend your life sort of in pursuit of creative endeavours with no one telling you what to do, no one telling you if it's any good, and never knowing if you're going to sell anything. That's already quite remarkable. And then to put two of you in one relationship, in one household, is kind of really exciting if you think about the kind of the passion and the enthusiasm, but all of the things that could go wrong because of rivalry or jealousy, or, you know, what happens if you're making your art together as a duo and then you split up and then your entire career revolves around your personalities being hinged together because art's very personal, and yet you've broken up. You know, that's a really interesting subject. So it was quite interesting. But though I have to say, I spent some time with Annie Morris and Idris Khan. They're great friends of mine. And we did an event at their studio last week. And the first thing Idris said to me when he saw the book in the flesh for the first time was, how many of them stayed together? And I realised he was kind of very cautious because he's married to Annie. They're madly in love and they hate the idea that all of these relationships are doomed to failure. And I was pleased because when I went through the list, I thought actually a lot of them, you know, they may have been unconventional relationships, but a lot of them stayed together for a very good innings.
I want to just pick up on that. You mentioned the sort of difference between two artists together because they love each other, but working separately and then working collaboratively. What were your reflections on that? You know, you have Ule and Marina Abramović, who for years shared this very intense performative practice that was also their relationship and that culminated in that amazing breakup kind of performance. Gilbert and George, who functionally are just one artist. But then, you know, others who maybe each have their own, as Fernando says, egos to kind of deal with alongside the relationship. Were there any patterns that you noticed within those two subsets?
I think one of the things I noticed actually is those that collaborate seem to be one way or the other, and they kind of divide into two. And one is so passionate and so fiery and so intense that they basically burn themselves out. And they just can't sustain it. And I think that's certainly true of Marina and Ule. It's true of Tim Noble, Sue Webster. And then there are other duos where it's almost impossible to distinguish life and art. And it's, as you say, with Gilbert and George, almost impossible to distinguish them as two. In fact, I got caught out recently because I had to say who was Gilbert and who was George. And having just written a book about them, I failed. And actually, you can't tell the difference between them as people and them as artists. They are living sculptures, and they have basically been so since 1967. And that's it. No trace of the real men has been seen since. So it's almost like some of the duos, like Bernd and Hilabesher and the Kabakovs, Gilbert and George, they kind of sacrifice themselves to the temple of art. Everything is subsumed by that. And then there are other duos where, you know, the artistic collaboration can only really last 10, 12 years. And you realise it's a very remarkable thing to stay working together for that long.
And Kate, one thing that I noticed in some couples as well, one overshadowed the other. And we have the question of gender imbalance. I think here of Jackson Pollock and his wife, Lee Krasner. So did you notice this pattern as well?
Yeah, I mean, I had to be really careful that I didn't effectively write a book which was about the little wife syndrome, as I call it, which is Lee Krasner, Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning and his wife, Elaine de Kooning, Max Ernst, Dorothea Tanning, Kay Sage, Eve Tongi. I mean, you could go on and on. And I thought that's a bit repetitive. And I do a lot to promote and champion women artists, but I didn't want it to be seen, this book, under the bracket of pure revisionist feminist history. So there are a percentage of those stories, and I think it's a really exciting time. I mean, yesterday evening it was the opening night of what I think is going to be a big blockbuster exhibition for Lee Krasner, her first in Europe for 40 years, I think. And that's at the Barbican, and it's time that we reassess Lee Krasner and she comes out of his shadow. But I also wanted to point out that a lot of these women, Elaine de Kooning said just before she died, "I was never in Willem's shadow, I was in his light." You know, they had, you know, really healthy, extraordinary respect for the men that they were married to and that they admired so much. And so there's a tendency maybe that we can accidentally demonize the man in the relationship, and actually we should be looking at the kind of the constructs of the art world and how problematic that is. And it wasn't just women. I was also trying to rectify this kind of very linear, very, yes, male-centric, white-centric, straight-centric perspective we have on Western art history. So there's obviously same-sex couples in the book. I look at Jacob Lawrence and Gwendolyn Knight, who are, you know, really, really important figures in the Harlem Renaissance. And of course, now that there's a lot of, thank goodness, more critical and commercial attention for African-American artists, it's really important to see them in the context of there were artists working throughout the 20th century, you know, in a really healthy, really robust, really important way. And it's just that we've sidelined them slightly. So it was kind of using Frida and Picasso and that kind of great light that they have to kind of divert a bit of the attention onto some of the other artists who we, you know, we don't know much about. It's not our fault. You know, we've been channeled one art history. So it was a nice opportunity to go and explore those guys.
I think what's lovely as well about it, as you say, you know, to go back to this idea that you didn't want to get too involved in the kind of husband overshadowing, and, you know, these couples, the book is the art of love, right? And these couples' relationships exist for themselves in their own kind of world. It's quite, I mean, it must have been quite a lovely thing to try and write from inside that relationship rather than bring all the kind of societal expectations of shadows and little women, and like all of these things to bear on it, and to say, well, you know, Willem de Kooning's wife, as you say, was in his light, not his shadow.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Krasner definitely made life more difficult for herself than she needed to. You know, she was pretty punchy. She didn't want to be sycophantic to the art world that had sort of effectively kind of raised her husband up on a pedestal and broken him because he became so famous and inflated his prices, and she saw the whole thing as murky. She could have played the game differently if she'd wanted to. So I wanted to be realistic about these stories. And I talk about in the introduction about this kind of thorny issue of biography, because in a way we want art to stand apart from its makers. We want it to be slightly purer. You know, I've just done a TV program about Van Gogh. Van Gogh's my favorite artist since I was a child, and I've read all his letters to make the program, and now I need to unlearn the letters because he's so filthy to his family. Same with Picasso. Picasso's, you know, just indisputably the artistic giant of the 20th century, but you just don't want to hear about the way that he treats people. He's, you know, extremely difficult.
Or Lucian Freud, horrendous. Yeah. Like Geordie Gregg's
so
biography.
Yeah, so biography is difficult, but in this instance, I felt that it was a very valuable tool if you sort of used it correctly to shine a light, to both bring new people to art, but also to unlock artists that we all know actually really well. And we might not realise that Rauschenberg and Johns were in a really, really important relationship with one another. And if it hadn't have been for that relationship, they wouldn't be the artists that they went on to be.
And Kate, I mean, you work at Soho House as well. Mm. I mean, do you feel inspired? Because I presume you have there a lot of couples that work perhaps in the same industry, like the art industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, I'm really lucky because quite a few of the people in the book are in the Soho House Art Collection. So I have the, you know, the privilege and the benefit to be able to ask them questions. So I was quite pleased that I was able to do about 150 years of art history in one book, and actually through to the living artists that I could interview them and talk to them about their practice as someone who collects it on behalf of Soho House. So yeah, it put me in a very nice position with which to be able to do more research. And I think, you know, that was another thing about the book, was not using photographs, instead having it illustrated, was a way to make, you know, like Victorian imagery of Camille Claudel and Rodin feel just as relevant as imagery of Tim Noble Sue Webster looking like super cool. If you'd put the photographs side by side, then it would be too easy as maybe a younger reader or someone new to art history to dismiss those kind of very grainy Victorian photographs and think that those artists and their stories are not going to speak to you and are not relevant. And of course, the theme is so universal that of course it's relevant. So it kind of created an even playing field using this illustration. And it's an artist actually who's based in Istanbul, where Soho House has a club. So it feels like quite a nice global book. A lot of it was written on planes because I travel so much for Soho House.
Tell me, what did it bring to your understanding and your kind of appreciation of these artists' work? You know, we haven't spoken much about the work. Were there new vistas that opened up? Did you kind of find yourself looking at things differently?
Yeah, I certainly did. I think that particularly for example, Rauschenberg and Johns, I didn't realise that Johns wasn't an artist until he met Rauschenberg. You know, Rauschenberg effectively put him into the art world, helped him get his first solo show, encouraged him to become an artist. And likewise, Johns really helped Rauschenberg's practice develop. He even nicknamed his work the Combines, which went on to become the sort of the term that we now use to define what Rauschenberg created in the wake of abstract expressionism. And so I really understand their work a lot better through understanding this relationship. So I hoped that was helpful for other people. And there's lots of examples of that. And then also just thinking about Marina and Ulay, you know, this 12 years of being completely fused and locked together. I think if you tried to write a PhD thesis without talking about their relationship, you would just have to fail at the first hurdle. You just can't separate their life from their work. And there are just some artists who are so unbelievably generous. They kind of bleed art, and their life and their art is so fused together. And so the prism of the love story is not just interesting, but it's fundamental.
Finally, to not to be too kind of glamour relationship advice about it, but what did you take away from that in terms of those things? You
know? Well, someone already asked me this, and I think one of the things that I learned was a bit frustrating, actually, having had a very sober time writing it because I had no social life and I'm now 6 months pregnant, so my life is extremely sober, was that I realised that actually you have all this advice, which is, you know, don't be an asshole, don't drink, don't smoke, don't gamble, live a really pure life. And all the people in the book that did all of those things seem to have had quite exciting, quite extraordinary lives, quite explosive relationships, full of passion, full of drama. They went on to be sensationally famous and expensive. So I know it's really, really bad advice, but there seems to be a thread through the book, which is, you know, I think we love voyeuristically living a wild life through artists. So it was enough. It satiated me enough just to live a wild life through them.
That's nice. A vicarious sort of thrill. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. The Art of Love, the Romantic and Explosive Stories Behind Art's Greatest Couples is out now from White Lion and Quarto Books. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for a tune. We'll be hearing from musician Erland Cooper in a moment. So this is from his recent album, Soul Scary. This is First of the Tide.
That was First of the Tide by Erland Cooper, taken from his new album, So Scary.
Musician Erland Cooper has found success over the years in acts such as Erland and the Carnival, whose folk-tinged indie rock he's created five albums with, and The Magnetic North, a collaborative project exploring more esoteric sounds, influenced by landscape and a sense of place.
His latest album, under his own name, explores more of that psychogeographic territory. So Scary combines sounds and influences found amid his life as a musician and producer in London, and also takes orders from where he grew up, the Isles of Orkney off Scotland. Monaco Stonehall caught up with him earlier to learn more.
Cooper, thanks very much for joining us. Here to talk about the new record, Soul Scary. Am I saying that right? Is there a way to say it?
I love the way you're saying it. In fact, it really tickles me. The song choices, the titles, using these Orkney words, yeah. Hearing people like your good self pronounce them on radio absolutely makes me smile ear to ear.
Well, I wanted to sort of start on some of that. I think you're being very kind to the way I'm probably saying some certain things, but I mean, we won't go track
go
through
on.
Track,
but do it,
we've
do
got
it.
We've got Spoot Ebb.
Spoot Ebb, that's good.
Okay. We start on a song that's just ha.
Ha is a very Scottish word, not just Arcadian. Ha. You've got to roll your R.
Har. or am I getting sort of too Nordic? We'll come on to that. But,
that's good.
And we've also got Groaty Buckies.
Oh, Groaty. Well, it's Groaty Buckies.
Right, okay.
And for such a kind of offensive sounding word, Groaty Buckies is actually it's the most beautiful thing. It's the tiny little shells that children collect on the beach and make necklaces out of them as kind of keepsakes. But it's got this horrendous name, Groaty Buckies.
We're almost getting ahead of ourselves. Let's tell people what this record is, where it sits in your canon, your over, as they would say. What's the premise behind this record?
This record forms part of three albums, actually combined. I wrote a record called Soul and Goose last year, released it, but it wasn't a record I planned on releasing, actually. It was just music to ease a busy mind at the time, and I was writing between the cracks, you know, in between other projects. You talked about Chalk Hill Blue earlier when I walked in, which was a record I worked on. I'm constantly working on other people's music, and when I would arrive at the studio, before I would start someone else's session, their mix, their production or writing, I would kind of get maybe 20 minutes to myself walking into the studio, having been outside, perhaps travelling in the underground. There's kind of a cacophony of sound, which is a bit chaotic, particularly to my brain. I think stress is relative. So, you know, a fighter pilot or a receptionist can both feel stressed. And so I was going through particular period of stress, and I would arrive at the studio and I would take the tone or the noise or the frequency of, say, the kind of jackhammer of, you know, the builders outside the studio, and I would turn it into a gentle tone inside the studio with a vintage synth, and then I would improvise over it, and then I would start whatever job I was there to do. And after a while, I'd built up quite a lot of layers, quite a lot of songs, and I would just listen to them on my own as I would kind of in between sessions or on the underground in London. And I started to name them after local birds in local Orcadian dialect. And it was just a way to trick my brain into kind of passing 10, 15 minutes. I would ask myself, for example, what's the name of the puffin in Orcadian? That's Tammy Norrie.
Of course.
Of course, you know that. Before I knew it, you know, 15 minutes had passed. I was at Old Street. And I had this collection. This record just came together after a bit. And I kept it to myself for 6 months, purely to ease a busy mind. That was it. But the minute you give something away, the minute you create a record or you write a book or paint a picture, when you give it to someone, it's no longer yours, which is absolutely fine. But I kind of missed having something that I could enjoy whilst I wrote Between the Cracks or travelled around. So I set about the full trilogy, which is all based on a poem by local Orcadian George Mackay Brown.
He'd gone out, it was almost the scene to go before daylight in the morning. Uh-huh. What his errand at the shore was, I don't know. But he saw this woman sitting on a rock. And I think he must have suspected she was a seal woman. He watched her and saw her take the seal skin and put it on and swim away. So he was down the next morning again waiting. And she came ashore, as usual, the seal came ashore anyhow, and then...
This record, I mean, it obviously focuses on a lot of the sound occurring on Orkney. Am I getting confused here? Does this record also feature the sounds of London as well, or have you tried to sort of fit it to a quite strict brief of where it is you're taking the sounds from?
It's a good question. There's definitely elements of both city and landscape of the natural world combining. I think that's the key for me. There's elements of distortion in this record that have perhaps come from a cityscape. But for me, I'm only trying to capture an essence of something. I'm not trying to be completely, otherwise I would just work for the tourist board. It's about...
I was going to say, you're not soundtracking a tourist video, are you?
Exactly. But you know what I mean? I mean, it's so easy to make something saccharine, or if that's the right word, and you put that music to the picture and all of a sudden it's dancing and singing. That's too easy. But going back to your question, someone said to me, or this kind of cliche that you have to be in the landscape, in a studio, surrounded by panoramic views of the ocean to write about the sea in any good way, or perhaps in the landscape to write about the landscape. I completely disagree. I think you need to travel to that place, whether real or imagined, whether it's in your head or a real place. Go there, take a snapshot, take a tracing, take notes, take field recordings, and take them back. Like your studio here, there's no windows apart from our lovely engineer over there. Hello.
Dave is one of the most stunning panoramic views that anyone could lay eyes on.
He is a rare bird. But you know what I mean? So it's this idea that I've been calling it critical distance. So it's like I know very quickly when I come back to London in my studio under the street with no windows at all, when I pull up 10 hours of field recordings and, 4 hours of ambient drones recorded in cairns, I know exactly what to discard and what to keep. And I wouldn't have known what to discard and what to keep without actually having come back from that place. And it's the things that immediately remind me of the essence of that place. Then I know for me it's working.
And it's also to do with, I'm sort of putting my own slant on it, but I mean, it's to do with ways of listening as well as ways of recording and compiling. Because I mean, I know it's like Eno 101, but I was reading about Brian Eno the other day, basically his Wikipedia. And I didn't realise that he got into ambient music the first time around because he'd been really sick and his girlfriend bought him an LP of like weird heart music and his stereo was slightly broken. So it wasn't playing correctly. And also he was so ill, he didn't want to get up and change it. So he kept listening to this stereo and this strange music in the wrong way. And it became something that was completely new to him that he'd not heard. Like if you're listening to the sound of the sea or the sound of a bus and you're sort of drifting in and out of focus and stuff like that, it's like you suddenly start to hear things in completely different ways than even if they're very, very familiar sounds. Is that something you agree with?
Totally. I love his use of language in describing ambient music. I think he says it should be as interesting and as disinteresting combined. You shouldn't focus in too hard, and you never stare at a light bulb, but a light bulb can completely transform a room.
It's basically a mid-90s magic eye picture, isn't it?
That's a good point, actually. God, I miss those.
Thank you.
Talk us through then the kind of nuts and bolts, having just talked very subjectively about the whole theme, but yeah. Who's on this record and collaborators and what kind of instrumentation and stuff were you bringing to it? You're always working with different interesting people.
For me, collaboration is the lifeblood of the music I make now. As I said, you know, when someone else can take those notes that anyone could do in any order and make them sound beautiful. Anna Phoebe, violinist. Clara Schumann, cellist, and she's become the voice of the sea on this record. Jacob Downs on viola. I like to work with folk and maybe get them to do something that they're not famous for. Chris Drever, brilliant folk musician and singer, with an incredible voice. So I ask him to read a poem by Will Burns. Catherine Joseph, again, I mean, she does very beautiful magic, powerful, almost witch-like spoken words. So I got her to read the same poem that Chris reads at the start of the song and she reads at the end. And one feels like a kind of sermon and the other one feels like a prayer.
To believe in the sea as ebb and swell, as deep home, as home from home.
I love that, you know, both artists in their own right reading the words the way they feel, having not heard the music. That's the other key. Hiroshi Ibina, I found online. I just loved what he was doing with tape loops, ambient work he was creating, the noises, the textures, and I reached out and said, would you be open to collaborate on a project I'm working on, but just based on a sentence, on a narrative, I'm not going to play you the music. And, you know, the answer is either going to be no, bugger off, or yeah.
And what was the sentence you gave him?
I think I said something like...
Bugger off.
I think I said... Well, for me, the narrative of the record, it's not just about the sea, it's about safe places. So it's about nurturing those kind of little sea havens. We all go to bed somewhere, we all wake up, we all go out into the world and anything can happen, but we all come back and we all sleep. And it's about nurturing those safe places. And I think I'd said, imagine you're on a wee flatty boat, which is, you know, the rowing boats. They're called a flatty in Orkney and Stromness. And you're rowing out, sounds really naff, but you're rowing out into a storm, up and over the waves, and it's really ferocious, and then you get a moment of calm, and that was it, and he came back. I think I gave him a line of cello, which was just one line, almost like Christopher Nolan and Zimmer's Joker theme in Batman.
Right.
It was just one line of cello, which is quite ominous, and then Clara Schumann just kind of did some tremolo distortion, some tremolo layers around it, and I just sent him that. And he came back with the most beautiful tones I didn't expect. And I would have done differently in my studio. And he had no idea how it was going to sound. And I just sent him the record and he's blown away, you know, because he's an unexpected collaboration and there's trust there.
I wanted to talk about Orkney, the place, as well. I've never been, so that's a very quick conversation. But one of the things that I was interested in the fact that you're sort of, I know that you're not working for the tourist board or anything, but you are trying to embody a sense of location. I'm interested to learn whether you see that sensation of capturing that landscape in a sense of escape from the city that you live in, London, or do you see it more as a feeling of like coming home? What's the relationship between where you are now and Orkney, the place?
That's a really good question. If you go back to this kind of feeling of only capturing an essence of something, for me, it evokes childhood memory, and anything that does that, and I'm not for a minute saying I had the beautiful, brilliant, perfect upbringing. It was magic, but there were difficult times too. But there's an innocence and a purity to it. There's a simplicity I'm trying to capture. Whilst this is Orkney to me, and I love folk to go and travel there, you know, get the ferry up or even fly on a bus with wings into Kirkwall, Orkney can kind of be anywhere. It could be real or imagined. It can be a place that you never ever visit, but you just love the thought of possibly going one day. And yes, it touches on escapism, but there's a romantic view of escapism, I think, or nostalgia. It can be quite romantic, quite sad as well, melancholic. But I think for me, it's more about kind of stepping in and out of your headspace. It's about looking beyond where you are. And for me, nature, or the idea of nature, but really nature itself has the ability to reset me. And so if I can get there in the art form of music, then I've achieved what I want to do, even if it just gets me there for a few minutes and then I'm whipped back to the London Underground. That's fine. It's a bit like, you know, you grow up on an island. Someone asked me, what's the best thing about Orkney? And I said, well, it's a rock surrounded by the North Sea. What's the worst thing about Orkney? Well, it's a rock surrounded by the North Sea. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like growing up, I couldn't wait to leave. At 18, I flew, left the island, hadn't been to a city. I flew to London Gatwick and then ended up in New York City. Blew my mind. You know, I remember talking to people on the underground in New York and they were swearing at me. Just the kind of complete culture shock. But equally now, I can't wait to go back. But I know when I'm back, and I've brought a lot of folk with me, some of which are in the studio there, 10 days is great, 15 days, 20 days. I'd love to go out for a long period, but I know that there's so many other things I want to crack on with. So it's about transporting yourself to a place quickly and back again.
I think it's kind of about a sense of other as well, because I think a lot of people experience that, because when you were saying how like you just wanted to leave, like I understand that. I'm from a quite mediocre seaside town on the south coast, and like I wanted to leave. I thought it was really boring, and sometimes when I go back there now, I think it's quite nice. But it's because you have that break away from it, and there's that tension and the relationship between constant sort of stimulus in a place like London and then the juxtaposition of peace and going back there. I think it's a state of mind people have to grow into, because when you're young, you just want excitement. Do you know what I mean?
Can I ask, does the sea play a part? Are you one of the kids who missed the sea? Because you grew up with it. It's part
of it. It's funny because the sea did not excite me whatsoever growing up, because it's a stony beach. It's not very attractive. But then I think that I never understand that I miss it until I actually go back. And then I'm like, oh, like I forgot that this is a thing. It's literally like an ingredient of my youth. Do you know what I mean? So it's like it's something that actually is probably like really hardwired into you. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And you only really understand it when you're looking at it and you're like, oh, yeah, like this is like kind of missing in my everyday. Do you know what I mean?
You've said that so eloquently, I'm going to steal that answer.
Go
that
for
I've
it.
Asked you, because I tried to put that into words and couldn't do it. It's in you, whether you like it or not. It's part of what balances you. Perhaps it's the horizon. Perhaps it's the idea of escapism when you're there, reminds you of escapism now, makes you can disconnect from your screens for a moment.
And finally, if people do not want to spend the outrageous sum of $9.99 a month on Spotify or something, and they can't hear your record, but they do want a taste of Orkney, what should they buy? What's the food of Orkney that they can simulate being on the island in their own kitchen, wherever they are?
Do you know what? I love the oat cakes and I love the fudge. The kind of oat cakes are really brilliant. You can get them anywhere. And a little bit of Orkney cheddar on top of an Orkney oat cake.
You're probably getting up to $9.99 now, so it's like they're going to have to make a really difficult choice between that and Spotify or whatever it is they use.
There's this famous flour, it's called bear flour, B-E-R-E, and you get these bear bannocks, or whatever they're called, bannocks. And I bought one from a friend, and they're so dry, but she was so polite, she didn't actually say, you know, you're supposed to put butter on it and some lovely stuff. And she just ate it and was like, oh, it's a wee bit dry. It was lovely.
It's delicious.
It wasn't good.
Erlen Cooper, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Erlen Cooper there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And Erlen's album, Soul Scary, is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. American artist Frank Stella, whose 20th century contemporaries include Cy Twombly, Jasper Johns and Jackson Pollock, is the only artist to have been honoured with two retrospectives at New York's Museum of Modern Art.
His works have helped shape our boundaries of understanding in abstract modern art, such as his groundbreaking black paintings, which made him an overnight sensation in 1959. He since moved into sculpture and was a pioneer of 3D printing long before the technique was widely available.
Now in his 80s, there's still more work underway. A piece of public sculpture for the Hudson's Yards development in New York will be unveiled in the coming months, and a collection of recent works are also on show at New York City's Marianne Bursky Gallery, appropriately titled Frank Stella, Recent Work. Monocle's Thomas Lewis recently visited Frank Stella at his studio in upstate New York and began by asking what that latest exhibition will involve.
They're pretty much new things. I mean, and the scale is fairly large, too. And we've shown a couple of the pieces were shown in Fort Lauderdale in a museum show about a year ago. But then there are three or four new pieces, and it's really about the images that we've made, which are derived from smoke rings, essentially, are really the kind of thing about turbulence and things moving, trying to capture it in a kind of way. It doesn't make much sense, a lot of particles, and then trying to make it into a solid thing, but it's a way of making a kind of sculpture. It feels as though the sculpture itself sort of moves. In a way, I suppose it's figurative. I mean, it's something like the Laocoon, what happens in that. It has a sense of a movement. There's something about the surface, which is a little different. It's really a painted surface, so painted surfaces aren't that unusual in sculpture because most sculpture, one way or the other, was painted. But we're very lucky to work with people in the Netherlands who are boat builders, and so the fiberglass work that we have is pretty special. It really looks nice.
The scale of the works here in your studio are really quite something. Is it easier or more challenging to capture the sense of movement that you were talking about there when something is much larger, or is it kind of easier to do it if you're working on a smaller scale?
Well, we have models basically for everything we do. I like the models, but then they're fine in a way. And so there are a number of models. So say for every 5 to 10 models, we pick one or do one or whatever, and we make it large to see what it's like, if there's much difference. And I don't know that you can tell that there's much difference. I mean, I think that if you put it in the magazine and you didn't put the dimensions there, I think you could fool a lot of people rather easily.
You were a very early adopter of printing in 3D before it was as common, it seems, a practice as it is now. I think that was in the late 80s, inspired by a perfume bottle, I believe. Can you tell us about kind of what sort of caught your imagination about kind of what painting in 3D, I suppose, could be for you?
Well, I think the rapid prototyping is really, it's just a kind of model making, but it was a way of making models that it's partly about the printing technique, but it's really about the geometry. And the printing realizes the geometry so you can see what it's like. But in order to build it or make it real in one way or the other, all that's needed is the geometry. It could have been still on the screen and we didn't have to make the 3D models. Fabricators could print off the plans with the geometry. But it was nice to, you know, see what it, and have some idea what it's going to look like.
And what did that enable you to do in your work in terms of the process of conceiving the designs that would then go and be printed and developed in 3D?
Well, it's more or less a question of geometry. So plane geometry, solid geometry. You can make pretty complicated pieces in both plane and solid geometry. But once you begin to introduce curvature and double curvature, it becomes a different area of geometry. I mean, to put it simply, it becomes, you know, a kind of exercise in topology. And that's the amazing thing about it, is that it's still be able to be measured, and so being able to build it. So if you can have some sense of what you want, you can pretty much build anything. You know, it has to stand up or not fall down or all of those kind of things. It has to be stable in some way. But, you know, you can make pretty unstable things if you wanted to.
Are unstable things slightly more fun to imagine and conceive?
Well, I don't know. You think, you know, what comes to my mind is sails. But then, you know, they're attached to the boat. But there are a lot of things you could do.
I wanted to ask about notions of patronage, I suppose, how those, from your point of view, have changed throughout your extraordinarily long career. I'm based in Toronto, and a very famous piece of yours was in Mervish Village.
In David's bookstore, yeah.
Yes, absolutely, which has obviously been torn down now, but the mural has survived and will be reinstalled somewhere else. You are working on a commission for the huge Hudson Yards development here. How has patronage changed, the people who want to commission you to do things?
You know, it's really pretty simple and kind of brutal. I mean, you know, you're an artist. The collectors are usually, they're certainly not of your own generation because they can't afford to collect you. So they're older than you are, and we're all fading away. Some parts of it are not so nice. I mean, you miss a lot of things, and things change. You adapt the best you can, but I don't have patronage per se. Never been lucky enough to be supported by anyone except my father but that was a while ago. But I've been in the art world for a long time, and the dealers that I've been involved with have all been actually, they're the patrons. They keep you going one way or the other, as long as they're interested or don't get a better idea.
Are there people who would come to you that you, at this stage in your career, would say, actually, no, thanks, I'm not that interested in creating for this project or whatever it might be?
We don't run across that many commissions, and I think it's true of all of the artists. A lot of the artists I've talked to, you come across commissions, but say, take a 2 or 3 year period, you get 4 or 5 offers or opportunities with commissions. You're lucky if one actually happens. And the commissions take a lot of time, a lot of discussion, this, that, and the other, but actually very few of them come to fruition, as it were, at least in my experience, but I've noticed it in the experience of other artists too.
And is there a freedom, going back to the exhibition that's coming up, are you in a position where you can sort of dictate the kind of show a show will be? Or what are the tone of those conversations like?
Well, there's not much tone to the conversations with dealers. I mean, a lot of people used to say, oh, he only paints what the dealer tells him to do, but that's a little naive. If the dealer knew what to do, he wouldn't bother asking the artist. He'd paint him himself.
So in terms of the pushback, therefore, I'm sure there must be elements of pushback.
Everybody has the dealer's job is to sell the art, and the artist's job is to make it, and the artist's job is to make art. It's difficult to define, but I mean, the consensus is pretty straightforward. Most people can tell what art is if they're that interested in it.
In terms of the experience of the gallery show, even, say, a retrospective or a longer view kind of exhibition of your work or another artist's work that's had a career as long as yours, what's the value, do you think, of exhibitions and shows like those now? Do you think we're in a different time? Is there a different value to them now?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the thing that it's hard to explain is that, you know, the institutions are still, everything is expanded in at least my experience in the art world, but there aren't that many more institutions. You know, you could say, oh, there are a few more private galleries. Some guys have their gallery in the woods and places like that. But that doesn't amount to all that much. And there are retrospectives, and that seems to be important to artists and to the public in a way. But there's a kind of limit. There's not that much gets shown. I mean, you know, of the artists who have retrospectives, you know, I've seen their work over 30 or 40 years, and I knew them when they started out, and it's probably the same with me. The relationship of the institutions to the artists is difficult. On one hand, they're involved in exhibiting them, and on the other hand, they're supposed to be involved in collecting them. And collecting is a difficult proposition, and most people think it's about the money. It might be a tiny bit, but it really isn't so much about the money as trying to act now and guess what the value will be in the future. You know, buy 10, two are going to be good 20 years ago. 20 years, that's pretty good. 20 years later. But 20 years later, the judgment about what's good is being made by people who weren't there 20 years before. So how do we know what they know anyway?
And is that relationship with the institutions, is that a frustrating relationship, or does it get better or worse, kind of the deeper into, say, a career you get?
Well, I think it's, you can't make art without the institutions, because there's nothing to look at. I mean, if the institutions don't conserve the culture and make it available to you, I mean, you know, when I came to New York, and I think it was true for most of the people, certainly my generation, the Museum of Modern Art was like going to school. Everybody went there all the time to look at the collection. That was it. I mean, where else would you go if you were interested in abstract art? You'd go see Malevich's painting White on White, tucked in a corner about, you know, 2 feet square. But that was it. And it was still pretty shocking.
And is it as shocking now, the institutions, to go and have those discoveries?
Well, the Malevich is certainly plenty shocking. Actually, maybe more so.
But the curation and the way that these institutions evolve, kind of, do you still go and see and have an experience still with these things that surprise you still?
Yeah, I go, but I can't go as much. I don't want to go in a wheelchair. If I can't walk around, I'm not going. But other than that, it's not a problem.
You've talked a lot about sort of going and seeing things for yourself and the importance of that in your own process. Mm-hmm. You spoke, I think, a few years ago about, you know, you can't possibly know the impact of the Sistine Chapel ceiling, for example, if you haven't stared up and craned your neck and looked at that yourself.
Did I say that?
I believe you did. Oh. I read that you did.
Oh, okay. I don't know. But yeah, seeing art, one of the best things is, true, we talked about institutions and things go into museums, but one of the great things about a lot of art that was made for, well, I guess the church was an institution, so, but anyway, they're still there in the place they were made for. people go gaga over Caravaggio, but seeing in Santa Maria del Popolo, seeing the paintings there, they've been there, you know, since the 16th century, so it's different.
And with your own work, therefore, this idea of a sense of place where the art was created for, is that something that plays into the way you make something or have made something in your career?
No, we don't have a place. I mean, there are museums, I guess, institutions, they have collections. But the place for me, anyway, and I think for all the artists that I know, or since for basically for modern artists, the place has always been the gallery. And so the galleries are the places, and everything that I've done and that I do is geared to the exhibitions that I have 1 year after another or every 2 years, whatever it is. But showing in New York and the work that I show there is about what I'm interested in, what I'm doing, and anybody can see it. I mean, we don't charge, knock on wood. They haven't started charging yet. So the galleries are free. Whatever else you can do knocking galleries, it's great because you can see what the artists are doing when they do it.
Notions of abstraction and the abstract in your work, how would you trace that kind of shifting idea for you during your career? And I suppose coming to the works that you've created now, is that a phrase or a concept that you hang things on, or is it something else?
No, I think in a certain way there's nothing to talk about. I didn't know either know how or be trained or even be interested in making art that wasn't abstract art. So, you know, I grew up with Hans Hofmann and Joseph Albers, and, you know, that was it. You can't get any more basic than that. And so, and it seemed to me at the time, and it still seems to me there are plenty of, you know, there's a lot of room, a lot of possibilities. Other people can do it. I mean, representationalism is whatever it's going to be. And, you know, good luck to them.
Frank Stella there speaking to Thomas Lewis. And Frank Stella's recent work is currently on show at Marianne Bosky Gallery in New York until the end of June. Og, it's been a pleasure. I can see you enjoy the show this week.
Indeed, I did. It was a very arty show between Frank Stella and Kate Bryan. We had kind of a bumper delivery.
It's fantastic. And I see the name of Jackson Pollock has been mentioned twice in the show. Three times, actually, now. That's all for edition 517 of the Monaco Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was the lovely Sarah Miles. The Monaco Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Augusto Macellari.